Welcome to the Recruiting Rant Podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez, senior analyst for USCFootball.com. Although we come away from another quiet week for USC football recruiting, that should change today. Although this podcast is being recorded on Monday, Mission Hills, California, Bishop Alemany four-star athlete Jalen Smith should be announcing his commitment to USC Tuesday. If he doesn't, it's going to delay this podcast, or I'm going to have to make some swift edits before it goes up. Presumably, Smith announces his commitment to USC, becoming commitment number 17 in the class of 2021. 5'11", 185 pounds, Smith is rated the number 15 athlete in the nation by 24/7 Sports and the number 29 player overall in California. While Smith is rated as an athlete by 24/7 Sports, he projects for USC as a defensive back, specifically a nickelback, that could end up being the third safety in a three-safety personnel package or the fourth cornerback in a nickel package. With his verbal commitment, USC should stay at number 5 nationally in the team recruiting rankings for the 2021 class. With that out of the way, let's get to the Recruiting Rant podcast thread, where the comments are unhinged and the questions are unremitting. Trojan 53 is first in line. He asks, GM, was Bo Collins a done deal to Clemson a while back, or did SC actually have a decent shot at this very talented wide receiver? Bo Collins, this 6'3", 195-pound, four-star wide receiver from St. John Bosco. USC was one of a handful of schools that Bo Collins was considering before he verbally committed to Clemson. But because he committed so early, it's really tough to gauge how serious he was about USC at that point in time. Over the past couple months, I have heard enough to surmise that USC has a shot at him even still, but they're going to have to really impress on the football field to even get him on campus for an unofficial visit, let alone an official visit. Green Trojan asks our next question, is Josh Simmons currently a take? If so, what position? Josh Simmons, a 6'6", 265-pound offensive lineman or defensive lineman at a La Mesa Helix High School, a three-star according to 24/7 Sports. Now, if you read the site Monday, you'll know that Josh Simmons is doubling down on playing defensive line. It's no longer a preference for him. He talked a lot about not having a fire or passion for playing offensive line, and he now wants to be reevaluated and recruited by each school as a defensive lineman. And one point I want to bring up, and I appreciate the question, Green Trojan, I think sometimes when you write an article, you don't capture the context that you had when you interviewed the subject. And the one thing I want to make clear is that Josh Simmons wasn't trying to throw USC under the bus. He wasn't necessarily saying that USC was trying to do anything shady or they weren't being upfront with him. He was just expressing his overall wariness and feelings that because he's been pigeonholed as an offensive lineman for the last 2 years, and many look at him as an offensive lineman and offered him scholarships as an offensive lineman, he has this natural inclination to be wary who wants to just say, hey, we'll bring you in. Yeah, you can play defensive line, but then they'll switch him to offensive line. That's not necessarily directed specifically just at USC. It's really an overall feel that he had. And I really just wanted to convey his wariness overall with the recruiting process now that he wants to specifically play defensive line over offensive line. On the flip side, I think when USC reached out to him, they were still trying to gauge how much the factor of playing defensive line was going to be weighted in his recruitment. Reading between the lines in my conversation with Josh, I think from USC's perspective, it wasn't necessarily, hey, yeah, we're going to recruit you as a defensive lineman now. It was more, hey, we're hearing that you want to play defensive line. Is it a preference or is it something that's a make or break factor in your recruitment? And I think at this point, it's now a make or break factor in his recruitment. Josh Simmons admits that USC is his dream school and there are plenty of factors that work in USC's favor in recruiting him. But I think what he wants is a reset. He wants to be reevaluated. He wants to be reoffered as a defensive lineman. Now the ball is in USC's court as to whether they want to pursue him as a defensive lineman or they want to continue to recruit him as an offensive lineman. I don't think there's going to be much ambiguity there. USC is going to say, no, we need offensive linemen. We've got to move on. Or they're going to say, hey, another interior defensive lineman, 6'6", 265, 270 pounds, wants to be about 285 when he gets to college. If Josh Simmons can show that he's a viable three technique prospect, USC's not going to turn that down. The biggest issue for Simmons is that if we don't have a high school football season, and I'm not real optimistic about us having a high school football season, it's going to be difficult for schools to legitimately evaluate Josh Simmons as a defensive tackle. I checked in with a source today who told me that Simmons came in at 333 pounds at the USC Elite Camp last summer. So he's changed his body to such an extent that you no longer have a true baseline for his quickness and his speed and his strength. Without senior film, that's basically what you have to project his ability to pass rush as a defensive lineman. Like I said, 6'6", 285-pound, three-technique defensive linemen don't grow on trees on the West Coast. But this is going to be a unique set of circumstances that USC is going to have to evaluate under. Our next question comes from David Law, who says, "Thanks as usual for doing this, GM. Two queries. First, how do you compare Miller Moss and Jake Garcia to the quarterbacks of the 2022 class, AJ Duffy and Malik Murphy? Second, what factors do you consider when you assess a recruit having high interest in USC as opposed to medium?" Second question first, high interest means USC is in a top three. Medium means that there's still a possibility that USC could end up getting an official visit. Of the quarterbacks you mentioned, all four are quite different. Malik Murphy certainly stands much taller in the pocket. He's a much bigger athlete than those other three quarterbacks. He has a really good arm. He just hasn't shown as much on film, and he hasn't had the type of prolific type of statistics that you've seen from some of the other quarterbacks because he really hasn't had as much time under the lights. AJ Duffy is the best athlete of the group. He's certainly the most accomplished runner, and that in Rancho Verde's offense, he runs the ball by design quite frequently. Duffy also has a really good arm, and specifically his deep ball placement is excellent. It's the underneath passes and the consistency on the short to intermediate passing game that we have to evaluate him further on. Moss probably throws the most catchable pass. He's probably the most cerebral and processes the best in terms of playbook and scheme. He's always been one of those players like a Matt Barkley or a JT Daniels that once he's thrown in to an offense, he absorbs it really fast. And you see that he processes where to throw the football really quickly. And with Jake Garcia, he's really the gunslinger of the group. He's the one that when he gets outside the pocket, I think he takes the most chances, but also makes probably some of the better throws because he can get outside the pocket. He has good footwork, and he's a pretty good athlete. He's not to the level of AJ Duffy, where you're going to have him running the read option, but he is able to get outside the pocket, keep his eyes downfield, and he makes a lot of nice throws when he does that. The next question comes from Big EBC, who asks, "GM, between Tia Sevilla and Josh Simmons, who are the O-line players projecting to play defense is the better candidate for us to pick up?" Tia Sevilla, the 6'3", 265-pound offensive tackle rated by 24/7 Sports as a three-star from Desert Pines High School in Las Vegas. I think Sevilla compares more favorably with Aaron Armitage, the 6'5", 265-pound strong side defensive end out of Blairstown, New Jersey. Armitage is a bit more athletic on film, and I think that's why he's ranked higher. In comparison to Simmons, Simmons would project more as a three technique. We're looking at him down the line, and he himself says he wants to be 285, 290 pounds once he gets to college. So a little different body type, a little different player, but I just got done saying it's going to be very difficult to project Josh Simmons as a defensive lineman when we have so little film of him. So projecting him as a defensive lineman in a vacuum is difficult. Comparing him to other players that have actual defensive lineman film or have been recruited as defensive linemen their whole high school career, that's even more challenging. Beta Trojan 64 has our next question. He also has a question about Josh Simmons. If Josh Simmons does decide to play on the offensive side of the ball, does he now project as an offensive tackle, parentheses, given his recent weight loss? If so, how do you think he compares to other offensive tackles in the region? Additionally, How are his feet and his wingspan? Well, I think we've established that Simmons wants to play on the defensive side of the ball, but even hypothetically, again, it's very difficult to project a player that's lost that much weight to another position when we haven't seen him at any camps. We may not be able to see him on film this upcoming season. There really aren't many periods and points of evaluation where we can project how he would actually look at another position. The natural inclination is to assume because he's lost 60 pounds, his speed and his quickness are going to improve equivalently. And that's not always how things work. Just because you lose 20 pounds or 30 pounds doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go from running a 5-flat 40-yard dash to a 4-6 40-yard dash. Some players just don't get that much faster. It's really a matter of diminishing returns, and you don't know how certain players are going to respond from that complete transformation physically. Trojan Tito 66 asks our next question. With the dead period extended, do you think there will be a spike in commitments, not just for USC, but other colleges as well? I do. I think you're going to see a lot of kids commit over the summer just to get their foot in the door with the class and then figure out what the NCAA is going to do for official visits, opening up the recruiting process at some point during the fall. The next question is from Ali for USC. He asks, if Simmons stays adamant about only being recruited and playing D-line in college, who is next up for the Trojans recruiting list at offensive guard to take his place in the offensive line class? That's a good question. But with USC signing 6 offensive linemen in 2020, I don't know that they're necessarily going to scramble to recruit another offensive guard just for the sake of recruiting another offensive guard. I think they recruited Josh Simmons because they like Josh Simmons. He's a very unique talent at offensive guard, and in my opinion, a very underrated player right now by 24/7 Sports, looking at him from the offensive side of the ball. Now, if he's off the table, USC's need is at offensive tackle. They've only offered a handful of offensive guards in the 2021 class. So they may balk at recruiting another offensive guard and just continue to recruit players like Kingsley Suamantia at offensive tackle, maybe a James Brockenmeyer, who's the number one offensive center prospect in the nation, according to 24/7 Sports, out of Fort Worth, Texas. There are some other players that they're after. Bram Walden, 6'4", 270-pound offensive tackle from Scottsdale, Arizona, currently committed to Oregon. They may just continue down the path that they started with and not necessarily veer or try to scramble and pivot to recruit another offensive guard just because. The next question is from Super Trojan 5. And looking at the size of this question, I read ahead and it seems that I've opened a bit of a Pandora's box. So I'm going to try to truncate this question a little bit just to make it a little bit quicker and a little more concise. He says, thanks for the detailed recruiting analysis last week on the recruiting podcast on the 2006 recruiting class. You are the best. Super Trojan goes on to ask about the 2007 running back recruiting class, which included Joe McKnight, Mark Tyler, and Broderick Green, following up that 2006 class, which USC signed 6 running backs. Well, first you have to remember that USC ran an offense with a fullback. So Stanley Avili was playing fullback. He wasn't playing tailback. And Kenny Ashley didn't qualify. So it was really 4 running backs that they signed. Allen Bradford originally came in as a safety, and he moved to the running back position. And early on in his career, he was actually playing fullback for USC. And then, if I recall correctly, Emmanuel Moody ended up transferring out of USC to Florida pretty early on in 2007. So that tells me the writing was already on the wall for him that he wasn't going to cut it at USC. So transitioning to the 2007 class, you have to remember Mark Tyler ended up having a compound fracture of his leg in the playoffs of his senior year at Oaks Christian. So he wasn't going to play as a true freshman. In fact, there was a lot of talk that he might not play football again at all. Broderick Green, they sold as the heir apparent to Lindell White, with Allen Bradford, again, playing fullback as a true freshman at USC. Joe McKnight, they sold as the heir apparent to Reggie Bush. Now, at the risk of this sounding like some kind of weird recruiting expert flex, Joe McKnight was actually silently committed to USC for more than a year. Those that were close to the program, myself included, knew that. Now, I might be misremembering the details, but from what I recall, McKnight had met a girl in New Orleans who was there on vacation that was originally from Los Angeles. The year before his senior year, when he was a junior, he actually flew out to Los Angeles, stayed with her family, and went to the Los Angeles Nike camp. That Nike camp used to be held on the campus of USC. And oh, by the way, Reggie Bush, who McKnight was being recruited to replace because USC didn't get Percy Harvin, they didn't get Michael Goodson, they didn't get CJ Spiller, Bush was now playing in New Orleans, which was Joe McKnight's hometown. And yes, late in the recruiting process, when McKnight was down to Ole Miss, LSU, and USC, of course, Ed Orgeron thinking, look, if I don't get him, I sure as heck don't want him to go to LSU where I've got to play against him, probably put in a good word for SC. Super Trojan also asked about Adrian Peterson, who was recruited the year after Reggie Bush and Lindo White signed with USC. He wanted to know, how legitimate were the rumors that Adrian Peterson almost commit to USC? They were pretty legitimate. From what I understand, he really liked his official visit. He was really thinking about USC hard down the stretch. The biggest hurdle for him was that his dad was in prison in East Texas, and his family visited him once or twice every month, and he knew being that far away from Texas, he wasn't going to be able to visit his dad. The next question comes from Sharmack, who says, love the RRPs, GM. Great job. Another one regarding Josh Simmons. Will USC still go all out to pursue his commitment, even if he's adamant at only playing defensive line in college? Also, anything to share in regards to Corey Foreman and USC? Is USC trending up, down, or flat with Foreman? As a defensive line prospect, I have to think that Simmons is maybe less of a priority because of the evaluation questions that still linger, as we talked about earlier in the podcast. As for Corey Foreman, I wouldn't say he's trending up or trending down for USC right now. I think the one thing we have to watch for him, he's going to be one of those handful of players that's going to have offers to play high school football outside the state of California if CIF cancels his senior season. That could play a major role in his recruitment. The next question comes from FluidHips33, who asked, of the recruits over the last three classes, which USC players who have not seen significant playing time yet do you expect to break out based on your expectations for them when they were recruits? I don't know if I'd expect it, but I'd like to see Raymond Scott get some run at either will linebacker or maybe in the star backer position in Todd Orlando's new tight front defense. I think he's a player that, having watched him in high school, has some really unique talents, especially his ability to cover. He is one of the best coverage linebackers that I've seen at the high school football level in probably the last, I don't know, 5-6 years. Another player that I do expect to have a breakout year and contribute is Brew McCoy. I think if Brew McCoy is healthy, he is that player. He is that five-star. He's a guy that can be a gravitational point within the offense. And when you lose a guy like Michael Pittman, you want to be able to plug in another big body. Brew McCoy could be that guy. And although he played as a true freshman, I do want to see a little more of Dorian Hewitt. I really like Dorian Hewitt coming out of high school. With his speed, his coverage ability, he's not the biggest safety in the world, but he's a really smart kid, played at a really high level of football in Texas at North Shore, and I liked what I saw from him last year. I want to see more from him. BU for USC asked the next question. In watching incoming freshman Jamar Sakona's highlight tape, I am not sold that he is agile enough or fast enough to play defensive line at USC. Do you see him possibly moved over to the offensive line? If so, what position? I'm on record as saying I like Jamar Sakona better as an offensive guard than I do a defensive tackle. Now we're going to have to see with this new defense how important the one shade is as a pass rusher as compared to just being a plugger or a body catcher. But yeah, I could definitely see Sakona playing offensive guard. And if you watch his film, he's pretty explosive and pretty violent at the point of attack playing on the offensive side of the ball. So that's not something that I would say is out of the realm of possibility. The next question comes from the Chubby St. Cloud, who says, GM, have the USC coaches or support staff now or in the past asked you any opinions or evaluations on recruits? No need to name those names, but you're well respected in USC recruiting, and I think it would help for all parties. I appreciate that, St. Cloud, but the coaches make a lot of money and have a lot of resources to do what they do. So if there's ever any opinions that are expressed, they're usually in conversation. It's certainly not one of those things where people are asking for evaluations from recruiting publications. Don Detta 4 asks, if Ma'a Noteote drops off, what other linebackers outside Ethan Calvert do you think we end up with in this class? When it's all said and done, who do you think has the best career at USC out of the class? I have no idea on the latter. That's way too far in the future for me to predict or project. With Yoteyote, I don't expect him to sign with USC. Outside of he and Calvert, who I still think USC is in a really good position to get a commitment from, USC still recruiting Rayshon Davis, the 6'1", 220-pound linebacker from Modern Day High School, still currently committed to LSU. I think linebacker is a position where USC is working some things behind the scene. I get a sense that they may have even more options there than we know, or let's just say more legitimate options than overtly obvious. R.S. Schindler has the next question. He says, GM, perhaps you can shed more light on this topic. Back in January, reports were floating around the P that David Aranda was in serious talks with Mike Bone and staff concerning the vacant defensive coordinator position. There was an immediate backlash from the anti-P or the anti-Helton P faction saying that this was fake news propagated by the athletic department in order to make them look like real players in the big world of college football. There was even a poster who said he had a friend who knew a friend at Creative Artists Agency, home of top-level sports and entertainment agents, who said the news about Aranda and SC was completely bogus. On the flip side, yourself, Ryan, Wix02, and even the legendary LV Lompro weighed in verifying the news of Aranda and SC was legitimate and on track until Baylor stepped in with a last-minute offer to be their next head coach, which he accepted. Can you discuss what really happened here? Many thanks for all your insights, past and present. Long question, short answer, not really. Everything that I got on Dave Aranda and his interest in becoming the defensive coordinator at USC came from sources associated with USC. So I didn't get both sides of that story. If you believe that the athletic department completely fabricated leaks that Dave Aranda was close to becoming the defensive coordinator at USC, then you just take it with a grain of salt and you move along. BFoss84 has the next question. He asks, you have mentioned that Josh Simmons' desire to play defense is actually what makes you like him on offense. Why is it not the same thing for Tia Sevilla? Is his desire not the same? Well, it's not Josh Simmons' desire to play defensive line that makes him a good offensive guard prospect. It's his athleticism. It's his agility. It's his footwork. It's his balance. It's watching him play defense on film, the little bit of film we have of him playing defense, and then how those skills and athleticism translates over to the offensive line. With Tia Sevilla, we're looking at a 6'3", 265-pound tackle. He's rated as a tackle. There's not too many offensive tackles that are 6'3". You've got to have extremely long arms at that height to play offensive tackle. But that's really a moot point anyways, because USC is recruiting him as a defensive lineman. The question then becomes, will Sevilla be a better defensive line prospect than, let's say, Aaron Armitage? Perhaps down the line, we could ask the question, would Josh Simmons be a better defensive line prospect than Colin Mobley? That's a fair enough question. The next question comes from NJ Trojan, who asked, where does Sierra Wright end up? Sierra Wright being the 6'1", 170-pound cornerback prospect from Loyola High School. I don't know where Sierra Wright ends up. I shook my magic 8-ball and it said, ask again later. The next question comes from C-Change, who says, hi GM, love the podcast. Thanks for taking the question. You're welcome. Can you pull back the curtain on how the Elite 11 quarterback process works? Aside from Jake Garcia missing the cut because of a bad day, I guess, at the Western Regionals, the list seems really weird. 7 of the quarterbacks are from Texas, but doesn't include Sawyer Robertson. And 3 of the picks are lower 3-star guys, Maddox, Kopp, Grayson James, and Jay Allen, who didn't even have Power 5 offers. In a normal year, would Garcia have had a chance to earn a spot at competing at a different regional? And because of COVID, were they canceled? To be perfectly upfront, in a normal year, I don't pay a lot of attention to the Elite 11 selection process. So this year, being that there are only two or three regional camps, I have to assume that most of the selection process was done by film. Miller Moss was selected because he won the Los Angeles regional camp, but they only had those two or three camps. So I think with a lot of the other quarterbacks selected, and I'm going to speculate here because, again, I don't know what the process was exactly, but you get the sense maybe they were looking for more quarterbacks that were under the radar, perhaps because they won't get a senior season to be able to obtain those scholarship offers. They're trying to give those kids a national stage where they can show out and they can garner the attention of schools. Miller Moss was selected, but again, he was selected because he went through the normal process of going to a regional camp, performing well, and earning an invite that way. The next question comes from SCPA5, who asks, what happened with tight end Brock Bowers and wide receiver Mekhi Cope? They were high on the board and now not considering USC. We actually addressed Brock Bowers not considering USC in the war room a month or two ago. The four-star Napa, California tight end eliminated USC because he wants to go to college in a small town. He doesn't want to go to college in a big city environment. Mekhi Cope had a scholarship offer from USC, but I never got the sense that he was being recruited as hard as a Troy Franklin or a Dante Thornton or Michael Jackson or Quandarius Davis. SCPA5 comes in with another question asking, why was Chris Polk more of a priority than Daryl Scott? Wow, we're really digging up some running back history in these podcasts, aren't we? Well, if you watch their NFL careers, or the lack of NFL career that Daryl Scott had, I guess you could say USC just liked Chris Polk better because he was a better player. As I recall, and I'm thinking back here, I believe Chris Polk played mostly receiver early on in his high school career. When he committed to USC, a lot of people projected him as a slot receiver. Daryl Scott was the number one running back recruit in the country at that time. He went from Moore Park to St. Bonaventure, and his recruitment kind of became a little bit of a circus. I don't know that USC necessarily prioritized Chris Polk over Daryl Scott. I think they just understood that Daryl Scott's recruitment was going to be crazy, and there was nothing going to be decided until the 11th hour right before signing day. But, you know, thinking back on that class, I want to know more about Sam McGuffey. Put that in the comments. Our next question comes from Tracy Pearson, a.k.a. BAMF95. Gmart, I set my jaw after your stiff arm with the repeat question. If there is a high school football season, do you see any under-the-radar players that can benefit and maybe USC look at signing? If so, any names to keep an eye on? I saw Mitch Liebers' tape, and it's impressive. He reminded me of Matt Grootegood. He is eyeing other schools, but USC I don't think is offered. I have seen Liebers' tape, and it is impressive. He looks like a really good football player. Competition level looks pretty low. I think the biggest issue for USC and him specifically would be that USC's done at safety. They've got three safeties. Anthony Beavers Jr., Zamirion Gordon, and Kalen Bullock are the three that they wanted, and that's the three that they got. So I think USC's done at the safety position. As for some other players that USC might consider later on in the recruiting process that certainly would benefit from a senior year, Elijah Lloyd is a cornerback at a San Marcos, California, Mission Hills High School that I like a lot. He just recently committed to Washington State, but he's a player that you watch on film. Although he's small, he's a player with a lot of instincts, some good speed. If USC was to strike out on a Sierra Wright or a Nathaniel Wiggins, Lloyd would be a good player to follow up with. James Bowles is another player, a 6'1", 215-pound running back prospect out of San Clemente High School. USC is going to need a second running back prospect in this class, and if things don't work out for Byron Cardwell, you get a guy like Bowles, at least you've got some size, and he's a kid that ran an 11 flat as a sophomore, probably runs closer to 10.9, 10.8 if he ran track this spring. The next question comes from Jacob Stein, who has three questions. Three questions in one page. That's against the rules. But let's see what the first two questions are first. Does USC take three running backs this class, considering how many running backs we lose the next two seasons? For example, Brandon Campbell, Byron Cardwell, and say, for example, a three-star that likes us a lot from Los Angeles or Texas. To answer that question, from everything that I hear, I think USC is looking to sign two running backs in the class of 2021. If the opportunity presented itself and they could get three running backs, and let's say it was two top running backs and maybe the third was just a three-star, then maybe they might take that opportunity to sign a third running back in the class. I think running back is one of those positions that if the best player available on the board come December, January is a good enough player, maybe they take an extra one. His next question is, any news on a transfer to help at the offensive line or quarterback positions to be ready for 2020? Or will have to redshirt, but at least be able to practice all season? I haven't heard anything new on offensive line transfers in about a month or so, but we did report in the War Room a couple of weeks ago that Brandon Costello, a 6-foot, 185-pound quarterback from Oklahoma State, originally from San Clemente, California, was in some conversation with the USC staff about a potential transfer. Not much more than that, just some talk, but there's potential that maybe they go and grab someone like Costello, who's actually more of a dual threat quarterback. But again, being originally from Southern California, there's some talk that maybe he would want to be closer to home. Costello was rated the nation's number 17 dual threat quarterback back in the 2019 class as a three-star by 24/7 Sports. Jacob Stein asked a third question that I'll get to on the second page if we have time. The next question comes from Mix, who says, USC wins 10 games, including a middle-of-the-road bowl game, but loses to Alabama, Notre Dame, and two Pac-12 teams. They don't win the Pac-12 title either. They win 10 games, but don't sign Corey Foreman, 5-star out of Corona Centennial. Would not signing him be a fireable offense even though USC wins 10 games? Would Mike Bone see past the number of wins and tell Carol Folt this isn't happening, telling her no way he can be our head coach while losing the top player in Southern California 3 years in a row? Not just the top player in Southern California, but that would be 3 years running losing the top player in the state of California. This is that middle of the road limbo that so many college football fans of blue blood programs fears. What's the quote from the movie Chernobyl as the lead scientist looks at the radiation levels in Reactor 4 and he says, not great, not terrible. That's the equivalent of what USC football would be next season if Clay Helton can only win 8 games. However, in this scenario, I would argue that winning 2 more games doesn't change that narrative. You still lost the Pac-12. You still lost the best player in the state of California, which is to say, in reality, you didn't really accomplish anything more than when you won 8 games. Your accomplishments are seen in your results. So if the president of the university and the board of trustees wants to see USC accomplish more than it did a year ago, and that is their expectations year in and year out, then in that scenario, you could not retain Clay Helton as head coach. Our next question comes from R5 Vasquez, who asked a question about Josh Simmons, and I think we've covered Josh Simmons quite a bit already in the podcast. He does ask whether he compares favorably or not with Noah Jefferson. Again, in terms of projections, I think it's really difficult to look at Simmons and compare him to other defensive tackles and other defensive linemen who we saw a lot play that position, where we haven't seen Simmons play that position very much. I will say Noah Jefferson was a hell of an athlete out of high school. Noah Jefferson played tight end in 7-on-7, and he actually was pretty good playing tight end, catching the ball in 7-on-7. If I was to compare Noah Jefferson with a high school football prospect in this recruiting class, it'd probably be more like JT Tuimoloau. Athletically, that's how much I thought of Noah Jefferson coming out of high school. The next question comes from P. Polly, who asks, high school football, public versus private. Do all schools have to adhere to state mandates, or are private schools given greater leeway in order to play athletics due to in part being private? In the state of California, all private and public schools are under CIF. So I don't believe that private schools have any more leeway or are treated any differently in terms of rules than the public schools. That's not true of every state. Texas has an association for private schools that's different than the public schools. The public schools in Texas fall under the UIL, whereas private schools fall under TAPS, which is Texas Association for Private Schools and Parochial Schools, I believe is what it stands for. And that separation happened many years ago because the parochial schools were recruiting in Texas. And there was public outcry that the public schools were being taken advantage of because those parochial schools were able to go and recruit kids from over the state. So in Texas, they made a distinct separation. TAP schools play in their own districts. They have their own playoff system and their own championship. The next question comes from Barnaby32, who asked, last year, it seemed like you planted your flag on both Drake Jackson and Drake London as quote unquote my guys very early in the recruiting cycle, as guys that were being underappreciated on the recruiting trail. Any guys jumping out to you this cycle? Any guys you feel are overrated on USC's radar? I understand there hasn't been much in the way of camps, so if you don't want to plant your flag just yet, it's understandable. Thanks. There's really no one in the committed class that I feel that strongly about at this point. I do think that Las Vegas Desert Pines three-star wide receiver Michael Jackson III is underrated by 24/7 Sports. I think he's underrated in general. I think he's a four-star that should be hovering around that top 250 nationally. The next question comes from Chris Trevino, who asks, what is your death row final meal? Starter, entree, and dessert. Wow, what a morbid question, Chris. Death row final meal? Jeez. Well, first and foremost, I guess I'd like to take this moment to say that I'm innocent of all charges. Don't believe what you read on the peristyle. Mistakes were made, but I was most likely framed by Chris Trevino. But to answer your question, I'd love to give you some niche menu items from restaurants I've been to over the years. But honestly, I'm simple. When it comes to food, I like sugar and I like smoked meats. So for starters, give me some homemade chocolate chip cookies. For entree, give me some type of smoked brisket, maybe a tri-tip. And for dessert, how about an ice cream cake with a lockpick in it? Our next question comes from Hafoos58, who asks, anything on Clayton Bradley and where he may transfer? Yes, the former USC offensive tackle announced that he's going to transfer to UNLV. Best Lakers fan asks some porthole questions. Any of these names below that USC is involved with? If they are, can you say if we have a legit shot at any of them? He goes on to list 7 or 8 names, and to answer your question, no. I really haven't heard in the past couple months any of these names come up in USC circles. Early on, and we're talking about probably back in January, Jordan Parker's name came up, cornerback from Oklahoma. But since then, I really haven't heard much about any of these players transferring to USC. You got to remember that the transfer process at this point is sort of like the recruiting process. None of these transfers are able to take official visits. They're talking to schools, but unless that player officially visited that college as a recruit, then it's unlikely that they're going to transfer to that college, not having been on that campus, not having actually seen the school or the city in person. South Coast Trojan comes in hot with 2 questions. First question is, it has been said many times USC, in all likelihood, will sign more than 25 recruits this cycle. It has never been said, however, just how many that means. Are we talking about 26, 27, or are we talking 28 to 30 range? At present date, I think we're talking 26, maybe 27. His second question is, why hasn't USC made Wyndon Ho'o'uli more of a priority? USC currently has 2 linebackers committed. There has also been rumors of a mutual parting of ways between USC and Ma'a Nyantiote, and flipping Rashawn Davis from LSU is not something that should be counted on. With USC having success in Hawaii and Wyndon being a top 10 nationally ranked inside linebacker, I just find it strange that it isn't more a priority. Thanks as always, GM. The recruiting rant is one of the highlights of my week. If I'm remembering correctly, I believe Ho'o'uli was actually offered a scholarship by the last defensive coaching staff. So it may be just a case that this new defensive coaching staff with Todd Orlando just didn't evaluate him as highly and are no longer recruiting him. I don't know that to be a fact because I haven't spoken to Wyndon Ho'oulu, but I don't think he's one of those players, like you said, that's a priority recruit for USC. As I said a little earlier in the podcast, USC does seem to be recruiting the linebacker position with some amount of confidence in the options that they currently have available. They haven't offered a bunch of new players. Like you said, Ma'an Yoteote is unlikely to end up a part of the class. So if they're looking at two, maybe three linebackers in this class, it seems like they feel pretty confident with their options. It's similar to what we've seen with the wide receiver position. USC loses out on Troy Franklin. There's a lot of talk they're going to lose Xavier Worthy and Deontay Thornton to Oregon. It doesn't seem like they're necessarily panicking. They're still going with the options and the scholarship offers that they have on the board. It's a gamble. We'll have to see if that changes in the near future. Our next question comes from Kili'i, aka Special K, who asks, if you had to be a YouTube personality, what would your channel be about? I feel like Kili might be trying to get me canceled here, probably because of the joke I made about her iPhone this week. My channel would be called Guns, Games, and Memes. That's what it would be about. And I hear that there's an opening for a guy with a wig, mustache, sunglasses, who drives a 1988 Lamborghini Diablo. Kili knows this already, guys. She's just asking for chat. David Law's back for another set of questions. New page, new question. First question is about Georgia and Corey Foreman, which we talked about a little bit earlier in the thread. The second question is, if there is no 2020 season, do you foresee any Trojans who would otherwise likely be 2021 draft picks deciding to stick around for another season, like Amon-Ra St. Brown? With Amon-Ra St. Brown specifically, no, because I think with his training regimen and his bloodlines, he would feel like a year off, he would train harder and be in a better position than a lot of the players in the 2021 class when it came to the combine. So I think being able to go in, get into the combine next year, he would have an advantage over a lot of those players, and it might be something that actually motivates him to leave even more. Perhaps with a player like Talanoa Hufanga, who I think flourishes in college and enjoys the college experience, he might stick around. And obviously, those cusp draft prospects that USC has would have to think harder about sticking around because they might not even get invited to the combine. And if you have no combine numbers, no pro days, and no junior film, that's going to make it very difficult to get drafted. The next question comes from Reggie Bush Graduates. He says, hey, Jim, if you get a chance, can you tell the Reggie Bush and Percy Harvin recruitment visit story? And if you have time for a second question, what's your favorite video game ever and why? What's your favorite sports game and why? Bonus points for an answer other than NCAA Football 14. To answer the second question first, NCAA Football 14 is definitely the game that I played the most. Other than that game, probably Joe Montana Football way back on the Sega Genesis. And as far as non-sports games, The Division is the game that I've logged the most hours in. I played The Division 2 quite a bit as well, but I lost interest in it after they put out a $30 pay-to-play DLC. But if you're looking for a cheap game to play, buy the first Division game and get the season pass so you can play the survival mode. It's far superior than anything in the second game and one of the best expansion modes that I've played in any video game. It's really, really cool. The Percy Harvin official visit story for USC is ironic more than anything. Percy Harvin officially visited USC during homecoming when USC was playing Washington State. USC brought in a handful of pretty big-time prospects for that week, and if I recall, they won the game pretty easily, and afterwards, the recruits actually tailgated right next to where we had our USCfootball.com RV. So you had Percy Harvin, Michael Morgan, LeSean McCoy, who was actually in a full cast on crutches. And like I said, they came over to tailgate right next to where we were, which was on the tunnel side of the parking lot next to the Coliseum. So we could watch the interactions of the recruits and the current players. You had Josh Pinkard there, Terrell Thomas, Brian Cushing, Kyle Moore, but no sign of Reggie Bush. From what I was told, after the tailgate, the recruits and the players went back to the team hotel. That was where Reggie and Percy Harvin were supposed to link up. So it's like 8 o'clock at night. Todd McNair calls Percy Harvin, says, "What's up? What are you guys doing? Where you at?" Percy Harvin says, "I'm back at the team hotel. I'm just in my room." So Todd McNair asks, "Where's Reggie Bush?" Because Reggie was supposed to be the host for Percy Harvin on his official visit. Percy had no idea where Reggie was. So Todd McNair calls Reggie's phone, doesn't get any answer. But Reggie had several numbers. And you got to understand that was the season where Reggie was a Heisman candidate. So he had multiple phones. It was the whole paparazzi type atmosphere for Reggie Bush. So Todd starts calling a couple of the other numbers that he has for Reggie. One of those numbers happened to be Lloyd Lake's number. Now, if you guys don't know who Lloyd Lake is, he's the one that basically brought sanctions upon USC by going to the NCAA and Yahoo Sports and giving them all this information that he had paid Reggie and his parents to represent them in a new sports agency called New Era. So here's Todd McNair trying to get a hold of Reggie, and Reggie gives him a number for Lloyd Lake because Reggie happened to be at the club with Lloyd Lake and Michael Michaels, who was Lloyd Lake's financial partner in this new sports agency. According to the phone records from the McNair trial, McNair never got Lloyd Lake or Reggie on the phone that night. So Percy Harvin basically was chilling solo. The player that was supposed to replace Reggie Bush and be the next guy in line to be the playmaker and the gravitational point for that offense was chilling at the hotel by himself on his official visit. But what's most ironic is that the number that Reggie Bush gave to Todd McNair, the contact number that he had that he used to try to get a hold of Reggie that night, was eventually used against him in court as evidence to link McNair with Lloyd Lake, thus linking McNair to knowledge of Lake and Bush's relationship. But if you're the NCAA, don't you think that if McNair was using Lake and Michaels to pay players, that he would have hooked them up with Percy Harvin, the number one recruit in the nation, five-star wide receiver, the guy who's supposed to be the next Reggie Bush? Doesn't McNair make sure that Harvin and Bush are at the club together with Michaels and Lake? To me, it's further proof that McNair didn't know Lake, didn't know Michaels, and didn't really know what Reggie was up to. Our next question comes from Blue Line Troy, who asks, "Can Josh Jackson III come in and fight for some playing time with Kyle Ford out for the season? Or is he a redshirt candidate?" We might be confusing John Jackson III from Sarah High School, who was a blue shirt, with Josh Jackson, who is the Harbor City Narbonne three-star wide receiver from the 2020 class. If you're asking about Josh Jackson, which I think you are, the 6'1", 180-pound receiver who is an incoming freshman, I think he does most likely redshirt. I think he could use the redshirt. True, USC's depth isn't amazing at receiver right now, but I think if you can get some good contribution from Brew McCoy, and he could step up and be 75-80% of the player that people expected him to be as a true freshman before he got sick, I don't think you necessarily need to play Josh Jackson. You are going to probably play Gary Bryant Jr. I think just from a special team standpoint, it would be silly not to play Gary Bryant. He's dynamic. He adds a whole nother facet to special teams as a kick returner. But also, you really don't have any players like him in the receiving core. He's a guy you can put at slot or even the outside. With his speed, he can take the top off the defense and change a game. The next question comes from Bovard74, who asks, "If Clay Helton continues to produce mediocre results that can no longer be tolerated, will it be Mike Bone's call to part ways, conduct a search, and choose the new coach without meddling from the BOT or the administration? If a prospective coach has perceived baggage, it's understandable Bone would need to get approval from Carol Folt, the president. But if a prospective coach doesn't have any real character issues, will Bone be free to pursue who he truly believes is the best guy?" If you're looking to replace Clay Helton, you're going to have to buy him out. If you're looking for a proven winner as a head coach to come in and replace him, he's going to cost some coin. Those two factors by themselves will involve the Board of Trustees. Fortunately, unfortunately, I guess it just depends on your perspective of what the mindset is of the Board of Trustees when it comes to football and athletics. Carol Folt has stated publicly she does not hire football coaches. And that's true. I totally believe that at face value. However, what I also think is true is that she can fire football coaches and she can prevent certain football coaches from being hired. So the only way I see both the BOT and the president being almost completely removed from a coaching hire is if you hire a squeaky clean coach who comes real cheap. So you're talking about an offensive coordinator or someone that's more than likely not a head coach or would have to be a head coach that hasn't been very successful, that for some reason Mike Bone just thinks is going to be a really good fit at USC, and so he could get him on the cheap and he would have no character issues, no background, no controversy that would follow him to USC. In other words, a coach that would have a very similar background and resume to Clay Helton. CSUN Trojan has the next question, who asks, outside of Narbonne, why don't we recruit the LA City section? I understand most kids are recruited these days and private schools have zero residential boundaries, but why the lack of city kids? These private school boys are a bit soft, all of the accolades, but without the hunger or heart. Well, the reality of the situation is A, even the public schools are pushing the boundaries on their boundaries. So a school like Narbonne brought in a lot of kids that were from the South Bay, but even greater Los Angeles. And we've seen with, whether it be public schools or private schools, talent gravitating towards single schools. The talent in Southern California is not very well spread out anymore. But maybe more importantly, it's not like these parochial schools in Southern California are just taking kids from the suburbs. Plenty of these top players are from the inner city. A lot of those Bosco kids are from the inner city. They're not actually kids from Orange County or kids from high-income areas. The third issue is kids are more apt to choose schools nowadays. They can go out to the 7-on-7 circuit. They talk to each other through social media. And they go out and they want the best resources and the best coaching. And if the city section can't supply that for them, they're going to go somewhere else. They're going to go to Bishop Alemany. They're going to go to Mater Dei. They're going to go to St. John Bosco. Or, like I said, they're going to go to one or two of the city schools, but you're not going to see that talent spread out among a bunch of different city schools. And that goes for all public schools in general, whether they're in the inner city or they're a CIF school out in the Inland Empire. There's just a lot more talent at a lot less schools. Our final question of the podcast comes from Gaycall, who asks, when talking to recruits, what is their overall vibe about other staffs like UCLA, ASU, and Oregon? Do any head coaches or assistants stick out as recruiters who are a thorn in USC's side? Mario Cristobal's name comes up a lot with the players that Oregon is pursuing, not just with the offensive linemen, but with all the players, even the skill players. It seems like he has a very hands-on attitude with recruiting. Herm Edwards' name comes up now and again as well. As an assistant coach, Jimmy Lake's name came up quite often when USC was competing with Washington for defensive backs. In terms of assistant coaches and position coaches, I don't really ask details about that when I'm speaking to a recruit. I cover USC. So when it comes to details, I want to cover ground that specifically details the recruitment by USC. Greg Biggins, Brandon Huffman, Steve Wilfong, Blair Angulo, etc. Those guys are the regional analysts. So they tend to ask a lot of broad questions about a bunch of different schools. My job is to ask specific questions about the University of Southern California. So I'm not going to have this long conversation about Brian McClendon or some other assistant coach at another Pac-12 school. It's going to be specifically about the assistant coaches and the relationship that that recruit has with those assistant coaches at the University of Southern California. That is, unless a recruit goes out of his way to mention the relationship he has with an assistant coach at another school. That's going to do it for this week's Recruiting Rant podcast. I'm your host, Gerard Martinez. You can follow me at GMartLive on Twitter, or always reach out to me with follow-up questions on The Peristyle. Thank you to all our subscribers who participated in the podcast this week. And as usual, stay tuned to USCFootball.com for the best in USC athletics and recruiting.